A movie that really bombed. It was September 2012 when a group of people discovered they were fans of the Prophet Muhammad and decided to show their admiration by depicting his life in a short movie. Only problem was, they depicted him in the most unflattering way, as a crazy, rapist pedophile who preached violence. Of course, many Muslims reacted predictably. They burned stuff. A group of Christian Egyptian Americans who had been living in the States for decades basically duped a group of American actors into making this biopic. It was a D-grade movie, not even good enough for a DVD release. So, they did the second best thing and released it on YouTube instead. That way, the whole world could appreciate its horrible quality. Multiple death threats later, the American actors claimed that they were wrongly briefed about the movie and participated in something different than what they were promised. If there was a sort of World Cup of lost opportunities, Muslims should have taken first, second, and last place, because instead of using this as a way to reach out and change stereotypes, they went ballistic. Isn't it a wonder that when people accuse Islam and its prophet of being violent and extreme, the first reaction out of Muslims is violence and extremism? It's like pointing a gun to someone's head and shouting, "How dare you say I'm not peaceful?" Egypt had its own noob cipher of a Fox News talking head in Khaled Abdullah, who dedicated hours to talking about this piece of shit movie. He would show parts of it while mourning the idea that Muslims had submitted to the evil powers of America. The movie on YouTube hardly had over 1,000 views initially, but in 2 days, thanks to Khaled Sean Hannity Abdullah, the views jumped to 3 million. Anger erupted all over the Islamic world. Many American buildings were attacked, including those in Libya. This was the prequel of the Benghazi attack. You have heard it directly from a Middle Easterner now, so Republicans can find someone else other than Hillary Clinton to blame. America was demonized just because a few people carrying its passport made the movie. It kind of sucks when you are blamed for the action of the stupid few. Right? Now you know how I feel when a terrorist attack occurs and the shooter is a Muslim. Further demonstration and even attacks on American embassies occurred all over the region. Our brothers in Sudan were very creative. It seems they got confused and attacked the German embassy and burned its flag. I'm sure the pre-planning session went something like this. "Is that the American embassy? Yeah, the flag is colorful enough. It looks Western. Cool. Burn it down." In Egypt, riots erupted in downtown Cairo, outside the American embassy. The embassy was attacked and even had its walls breached by people carrying Al-Qaeda flags. The spokesman of the Salafi Al-Nur party didn't denounce the attack and even justified the anger, while he demonized America as an evil imperial power. 3 years later, he was finishing his MPA at Harvard. He wanted to get a degree from the same school as Legally Blonde's Elle Woods. "I was only a few weeks away from starting my life show, and then I got an email. It was from the producers of The Daily Show. They wanted me to do a piece via Skype as a Middle Eastern correspondent commenting on what was happening." What? John wanted me to be on his show again? Not as a guest, but as a correspondent. I couldn't believe it. Only a few weeks earlier, I was a total unknown to the American audience, and now I was being asked to be part of my dream show? This was too good to be true. Well, that's exactly what it was. The script was hilarious. It was about me giving an explanation of what was happening with all these Muslims, reminding John that Islam was a younger religion than Christianity and Judaism, and it was just going through puberty. Christianity and Judaism have already gone through their rebellious phases. Judaism with its ancient weird rules and destructive wars, and Christianity with the Inquisition and the Crusades. Now, it was Islam's turn to become a man. There were a lot of references to adolescent problems ranging from acne to bad sex. The satire was great, and I was incredibly excited to do it. I agreed on a time to be on air with them via Skype. I sent the script to my publicists, who fired back at me, "Are you out of your mind? Do you think you can make all of those insinuations in the middle of this terrifying riot? You think people will leave you alone?" They were right. There was a lot of anger. And as you know, angry people, especially religious ones, don't have much of a sense of humor. but I was blinded by the amazing opportunity to be on John's show. It was only 2 hours to airtime, and after too much contemplation, I sent them a long email apologizing for not being able to make it. The stakes were too high, and this could be a PR disaster. I was thinking John would hate me forever and never talk to me again. Then half an hour later, my phone rang. It was John. First thing he said was, "Don't do it. You should be safe." I continued to apologize, but he was very understanding. This was one of many times that I saw his humanity. He wasn't just some performer. 2 years later, he would again advise me to stop my own show for my safety. Apparently, comedy does have some boundaries. They played the piece anyway, with John Oliver taking my spot. Damn you, Oliver! Till this day, it is a mystery as to why those bearded men openly demonstrated with Al-Qaeda flags in the streets and got too close for comfort to the American embassy. The Salafi faces who incited the hate were all on the side of the army when they removed the Muslim Brotherhood a couple of years later. The police and military forces, who would usually crack down on anyone who would get within 2 blocks of the embassy, virtually disappeared from the streets. Something was off, and in the moment I couldn't put my finger on it. It's a wonder how blinded we were toward everything as it was happening. It seemed that everything was falling apart: the country, the live show preparations, and even my marriage. It takes 82 to tango. At this point, it is fair to say that my wife got cheated in this marriage. We met in 2010 while I was still a heart surgeon. At that time, I had hobbies other than making fun of TV pundits and politicians. I was a dancer. I loved to dance all my life. And I even used to teach Argentinian tango and salsa. In a conservative country like Egypt, a guy who takes up dancing as his pastime and even as a source of income is frowned upon, especially with an even more conservative community like doctors. Some of my senior colleagues and medical school professors used that against me. It didn't matter how good or bad I was as a doctor. The dancing was brought up at every turn. I didn't care, though. I didn't censor myself to please them, and I didn't give up what I liked to earn their approval. Maybe I had a rebellious streak all along, a rebel with a Latin beat. I always felt that if I married, I would marry a woman who appreciated what I did and even be part of it. Then came my wife, Hala, to perfectly compliment me. We both loved tango and had a passion for the arts. It didn't take long to seal the deal and get married at the end of 2010. We hosted tango nights in our house, went to classes together, and even spent our honeymoon at a tango festival. A few weeks after that, the whole revolution thing happened. I found myself time-sucked into the YouTube show, then the TV show, and then the preparation for the live show, with all of the political turmoil that came with it. Things got horrendously dark and busy. I married a tango dancing doctor, not an absentee TV celebrity, she used to tell me at the dinner table. With my newfound fame, and since the show started airing, I was never there for her. I spent all my time in the theater, supervising the renovation and getting ready for the big debut. Our team rapidly expanded. We now had a staff of 82 people. Yep, I counted them: producers, writers, researchers, technicians, and everyone in between. I was responsible for the biggest production in Egyptian television history, all while the Islamists rose to power and my marriage suffered. Till this day, I don't know why my wife stayed. She once told me that if I were another celebrity, she would have just walked out. But she believed in what I was doing. She too was part of a younger generation that was sick and tired of decades of taboos and the suppression of free thought. "This is not just another show. It is a statement and people need it," my wife told me. "I guess some men are luckier than others." My big day, or how great shows come with greater insults. For weeks, while rebuilding a theater out of scratch, tech rehearsals continued for hours each day. We were struggling with everything, from playing videos in real time to queuing photos and graphics over my shoulder. Nothing was working. I was losing my head every time something went wrong. Eventually, we started incorporating and practicing the script. Because of the incessant production interruptions, we didn't even know if we had a comedic show anymore. Funny or not, the big day was here. When I had attended John's show, they had a comedian who would warm the audience up beforehand. He would tell the audience to cheer and laugh and clap so the people at home would feel energized. But you couldn't do that here. If you tell Egyptians to laugh or clap, they do the opposite, because we are just too cool for that. I had to hope that we had created an entertaining show. I stood backstage waiting for my cue to enter the stage. I didn't want to mess up or do retakes. Khalifa, the director, spoke in my earpiece to give me the countdown. Then, showtime. The lights, the applause, the excitement. What the hell was I doing all that time taping boring pre-recorded shows? I took my seat. Here I was, a doctor, a surgeon, whose only theater before now was an operating theater where I used to cut people open. Nothing in my life had prepared me for this. I never received any formal comedic training, or any training in improv or acting, nothing. In my earpiece I could hear Khalifa and Hen giving final orders. Tariq was in the front row. All of those people who, months earlier, doubted I'd ever make it past the first week of the first season of a small show with a limited budget were watching, judging. I made my first quip about trying to justify how I ended up on this channel, which I admitted was for one reason and one reason alone, money. I went on to tear down every single person working for the network, including the owner. The theater erupted in laughter. They couldn't believe I was going there, and I couldn't believe that my jokes were landing. I continued on a more treacherous path, deciding to go after the almighty Muslim Brotherhood. I dissected their rhetoric and destroyed their beloved Renaissance project, and I showed people how they were using religion to manipulate the masses. What I was hearing in that theater was not laughter, it was catharsis. One joke after the other, one video after another, I was killing it out there. The first episode lasted more than 90 minutes, which I had never thought I could pull off. It was amazing. When the show ended, I went off stage, where everyone jumped on me and hugged me. Amr, Khalifa, Hind, Tariq, every single one of the crew who attended the boring rehearsals and doubted this would ever take off. I was drenched in sweat and out of breath, as if I had run a race. What the hell just happened? The history of Egyptian television was changed forever. In the next few months, everyone in the media wanted to do a Bassem Youssef-type show. Live audience shows started emerging out of nowhere. But our audience came of their own free will. They were never paid, and their reactions were unrehearsed. Our weekly show became a regional phenomenon. As expected, the Muslim Brotherhood lashed out against me. They didn't care about the daily demonstrations against them, or journalists and TV hosts criticizing them. They were worried about me more than anything. Authoritarian regimes, whether military or religious, are not worried about vicious criticism. They are worried that the masses lose respect for them. You can't really respect or fear something you are laughing at. But the greatest attack came from within the channel itself. The oldest, most veteran TV anchor was upset because I had made fun of him. He represented a form of new liberal authoritarianism, an older generation that wasn't used to being criticized. He went on his show and attacked me, but made the fatal mistake of trying to be funny. After belittling me, calling me all kinds of derogatory names, he threatened that he would shut down my show. Well, two could play this game, and I had the upper comedic hand. So I decided to go after him in my next episode. It was nothing personal, but if I didn't respond, it meant that anyone could bash me into silence, and I didn't want to set that precedent. This was me getting my TV cred. This was me going after that old mentality that built its glory on faux respect. The channel executives didn't want to piss off their oldest and most famous TV host. He was a media dinosaur, but his name was still a big deal. So they asked me to let it go. I said I just couldn't do that. My next episode was all about how Morsi was turning into a dictator. I told the network that I found it weird that they were more worried about the feelings of their anchor than they were about me going after the president. They suggested that we visit the anchor in his house and ask for his permission to be mentioned in the next episode. I was furious. I told them I would do no such thing. Tariq urged me to play along. "We have only broadcast a pilot. We can't afford to stop the show now," he said. "I beg you, be nice and be polite, and I promise you that you will get to do what you want." The deal was that everyone would be there and that the owner of the channel would be the one who broke the news about me joking back. The owner promised me that whatever the outcome, I could broadcast the episode as I wanted, but still asked me to do this courtesy visit to the anchor first. We went to his stupid house. He represented everything that I hated about our culture. The patriarchal mentality, the entitlement, the arrogance that came from the fact that he had wasted more years on this planet than the rest of us. He gave me a lesson on respecting my elders and how it was not acceptable to make fun of them. Just to give you an idea, this man was supposed to be the godfather of the new Arab media. He was the one who bragged about how he was more knowledgeable about Western media than anyone else. He owned the first private radio station and entertainment website in Egypt. He was also a close friend of Mubarak, which partly explains why he was given the privilege to spew all of his knowledge. I reminded him that in the Western media, there is no person above satire and sarcasm. He didn't accept any of this and continued to give me a lesson about respect and morality. 3 years later, this guy would escape from Egypt after allegedly amassing millions of dollars through bribes and shady deals with the media outlets he worked for. Respect and morality, my ass. I sat there waiting for the owner of the channel to speak about the next episode. Of course, he pussied out. No one else spoke. So now it was up to me to tell him what I intended to do in that episode. The Brontosaurus lost his shit. He told me that if I ever mentioned his name, let alone made fun of him, he would personally see to it that my career was ruined. He added, in English, "Mark my words, I will personally fuck you." Ooh, kinky. We left the house, and right there in the street, I told the owner in a calm voice that I would do this episode the way I wanted, and that if he didn't like it, he could terminate my contract. Tariq was not amused. The next day, I went to the office and finalized a special script about my dear Stegosaurus friend, which became the second segment of the episode. The first was dedicated to my other good buddies, the Muslim Brotherhood. They were using the Salafis to reshape the constitution to make it more Islamic. Morsi had prevented the Supreme Court from putting obstacles in the way of the new constitution. What was worse was how the Muslim Brotherhood had ordered its people to surround the Supreme Court building. They camped around it for weeks and prevented the judges from going in. This was a full militia exploit. Since the police wouldn't help him, he had his faithful soldiers do the dirty work. The pilot of our show was a revolution that rippled throughout the television world. But the second episode was a revolutionary wave that trailed against everything authoritarian. I crushed that veteran anchor. I personally went after Morsi, and I spared no sarcasm when skewering the Muslim Brotherhood and their militias. I did that at the risk of the channel terminating my contract, and also at the risk of going to jail. An article of Egyptian law that still existed from the Mubarak days stated that you could go to jail for insulting the president. This is how Egyptian laws are: subjective, extremely ambiguous, and innovative in the ways in which they can lock you up and lose the key. The channel didn't air the episode to avoid upsetting their anchor. Their explanation for the cancellation was because of live coverage of street clashes. People didn't buy it. We went ahead and put it on YouTube as a little virtual fuck you. The views of this episode were in the millions. It was a lesson for the channel that censorship wouldn't work with me. Under pressure from the audience, the channel backpedaled. They saw the viewership on YouTube going through the roof and everyone talking about this new show and couldn't afford not to air us. That day, the establishment bowed its head to the will of the people. No more moral police dictating what people should watch anymore. The show was now too powerful to be stopped. People gathered to watch it in cafes like Super Bowl games. They didn't watch us simply because we were funny, though. They watched us because they saw hope in the show. Hope to challenge long-standing taboos and authority. Whether that authority came in the form of a beard, or a tank, or a codger demanding respect your elders. Part 2. Risky Business. Condoms, Alcohol, and Rock and Roll. December 2012. Legend has it that the only populist power in the country were the Islamists. and that the others were merely a weak minority. We were the others. We were the ones the Muslim Brotherhood needed to win the election by a mere 1%. We were used as a tool for them to get the presidency. And when they won, they broke every promise they made us. Islamists were fighting for a divine cause, but we liberals were viewed as wusses who had nothing left in us to fight for our cause. Maybe because, other than not wanting to be ruled by religious dogma or a military dictatorship and seeking equality for all and other hippie principles, we hadn't really settled on a clearly defined cause. How can you compare trivial causes like human rights and freedom with a divine cause like fighting for Allah, whatever the fight was, or fighting for the country, even if the ones claiming to fight were in bed with all your enemies? The true liberal powers saw that they were duped and started calling for nationwide protests. I use true because later we will discover that many so-called liberals turned out to be fascists. They just preferred the whip of the military to the sword of the Islamists. Anyways, hundreds of thousands of disgruntled anti-Islamist protesters organized in front of the presidential palace. They had had it with the manipulation of the constitution and how Islamists were breaking one promise after another. Many of the demonstrators left at the end of the day and went home, but a few hundred stayed behind for a sit-in. When the numbers began to dwindle, the Muslim Brotherhood sent their militias to attack them. Many were killed that night, but the violence wasn't between citizens and police. It was between protesters and Muslim Brotherhood militias. Even when the Brotherhood were in power, they couldn't get the militia mentality out of their mind. This happened a few hours before taping our episode. Egypt was living through one tragedy after another. People were killed every day because of something. This became our own Columbine reality on a weekly basis. There was always this challenge of trying to make people laugh amid such terrible circumstances. But what could we do? If we closed up shop every time Egypt lived through another tragedy or unrighteous killing, we might as well not have a show at all. Nonetheless, my team implored me to cancel the show. They were worried about how we would be perceived. I was already stressed out because I still wasn't used to the timing of a live program and found myself shouting in the control room, "I can't just go and cancel the show every other episode. This is the country we are living in. Death has become a mere statistic. You will always find trolls who will say to you, 'How dare you laugh at whatever tragedy is going on in the country?' Well, guess what? The tragedies are about to get worse, and the trolls will watch us in secret anyways. There are people out there who need this. I am doing the show." The footage from the night of the attack was horrific. Many of the demonstrators were tortured by the Muslim Brotherhood militia, and the scenes were graphic and bloody. The anti-Islamic talk shows opted for the sensational angle. They got the most graphic scenes and ran them on repeat. When my researchers were looking for material, they thought they were doing a good job by getting even more graphic and horrific material to show how truly bad the Muslim Brotherhood were. I stopped all of that. "This is a comedy show," I told them. "This is not another talk show where we aim to be sensational. We need to deal with the worst tragedies and find a way to deliver our message in a way that doesn't repulse people." They looked at me in bewilderment. How are we going to find a funny angle in this? But we searched again, and this time we were not looking at the news. We were looking for what was behind the news. I directed them to look into the mentality that made these people do what they did. With the police and the army, it was always easier to find their motives. You are armed to the hilt, and you receive an order from above to assault, to beat, and to kill. The excuse will always be national security, or the sovereignty of the nation, or any other nationalistic bullshit. But what makes people, normal people, who go with us to the same universities and schools, and even share the same workplaces, view us, the non-Islamists, as targets to be tortured and killed? We followed the Brotherhood's and the Salafis' shows and their media and aimed to show our viewers what they thought about us. This was not an easy task. Their programs went on for hours. No one actually watched them except their followers. Yet, we had to watch the endless hours of bullshit to show the country what kind of sick minds these people had. My team had to endure the same agony Jon Stewart's team had to go through while watching Fox News. Now, that's truly torture. The same sheikhs who would insert and recite Quran verses every couple of sentences in their news reports as a sign of piety were now reporting finding condoms, bottles of Russian vodka, and vaginal douches in the tents of the protesters. The boys told me they found some of the most expensive liquor called ID 10%, as Sheikh said. Condoms were found in the tents. That's the kind of people we are dealing with. Hey, look on the bright side, Sheikh. Doesn't that at least mean they are practicing safe sex? Better than having angry protesters running around with herpes. It's interesting how these men of God get worked up about alcohol and sex while they promise their followers unlimited access to rivers of wine and sex with 70-plus virgins in heaven. It seems you can have fun in the next life, but never in this one. One video after the other, with live coverage from the battleground, showed the Islamists ransacking the tents of the defeated protesters and then holding condoms and empty bottles of alcohol to the camera. It would really take a moron to go out to protest the president while bringing this stuff with them. And it would take an even bigger moron to believe the Islamist media's lies. I was happy with what we did with the episodes that followed this disaster. We didn't show a single graphic scene. We didn't play the victim card. We didn't show the horribly violent clashes. We were true to the message of sarcasm and comedy, and yet we did what no other serious show or news outlet dared to do. We exposed those people for who they were. We showed the sick mentality that was driving these insane actions. It was easy to make people hate them, but more important, we showed how absolutely trivial they were. After those attacks, and with the continuous exposure of their hateful media, the reign of the Islamists seemed to weaken, at least in many major cities. Whereas previously any Islamist figure with an Al-Qaeda-style beard was considered untouchable. But now, those men of God were losing their credibility, and people were waking up. Now, a common name was given to them, religion dealers. It was a degrading term used to describe all those with religious authority who profit from religion. Think of your typical crooked televangelists, a la Jimmy Swaggart, and you get the picture. I went after them in every episode, and they didn't like it. They, in turn, dedicated most of their airtime to attacking me. They used whatever religious fatwas they could to deem my show as haram. Hey, look at you understanding two Arabic words in one sentence now. Way to go. In one episode, I showed another aspect of how these Islamist mind worked. Part of being a good Muslim was to be decent and respectful, and not insult other people, even if they smeared you or called you names. That whole do unto others mentality. Yet, it was a constant spectacle to hear and watch the worst kind of smear campaigns and the lowest kind of behavior of these Islamists towards Christians and even other Muslims who didn't follow their dogma. The way I ended the episode helped many people see things differently. I said, "You keep calling us infidels, unworthy of being good Muslims. You know what? We are fine with that. We are through trying to make you happy because there's actually no point in doing so. We will not be put through your guilt trips anymore. You see, it's a very simple equation. If we are not Muslims in your eyes, well, you are not sheikhs, scholars, or men of religion in ours. You are preaching a religion that we don't know and don't want to be part of. Keep that religion to yourself, and we will keep ours." Those couple of minutes of the show were replayed over and over again on television and online. They offered emancipation for many young people looking for a way out of this eternal religious struggle. As simple as it might seem, this was new for our region to stand up to the tyranny of the religious mafia. Despite being in power, they had no power over us anymore. Whatever respect they had was diminishing in the hearts and minds of the people, and the people in charge didn't try to make it better. They just kept on doing what they did best, becoming more arrogant, alienating everyone, and in the process, heading full speed to their own demise. The Curious Case of Abu Ismail. Think of a zealous religious conservative like Mike Huckabee, with his extreme fundamentalist quotes and his adorable smile. Then add some Michelle Buckman's non-fact facts. Then mix that with the bigotry of Donald Trump and the self-serving beliefs of Ted Cruz. Then go ahead and wrap everything up in the crazy that is Sarah Palin. Add a dash of twisted religious interpretation and a scary Islamic beard, and now you have Abu Ismail. Hazem Salah Abu Ismail was an Islamist leader. He didn't officially belong to any political party or group, but instead managed to create a cult of his own. He had one of those Santa Claus slash ISIS beards growing out of, I kid you not, an adorable baby face. He was in his 60s, but without the beard, he looked exactly like Paul McCartney in the 1960s. He was a lawyer, but on the side he had a more lucrative job. He was a television sheikh with his own spot in one of the mosques downtown. He was a different kind of sheikh. He didn't just speak about good and bad deeds, heaven and hell, or any of those regular topics about religious rituals and chores. He thought of himself as a different brand. He preached what we can call bullshit applied religion. He specialized in speaking about matters that are important to a bigoted Muslim, such as how the Western world is a degenerate, filthy place that is trying to destroy Islam in every possible way. He was known for his ability to uncover the Western conspiracies against Islam. One of his famous television lessons showed him explaining that the soda company Pepsi had led a conspiracy. Yes, Pepsi, the one related to child obesity, sugar addiction, and Beyoncé. He said that Pepsi was an acronym for Pay Every Penny to Save Israel. I will give you a moment to digest all of this. Okay, we're back. He was out there spreading a utopian image of the Islamic Empire. We ruled the world because we were better Muslims. For the likes of Abu Ismail, a vibrant era is only measured by the extent of its geography. They don't tell you about the atrocities committed by the many caliphs and war leaders, the same way Christians choose to omit what the Roman and Spanish empires did in the name of Christianity. When you try to reason with Abu Ismail and his contemporaries, the answer will simply be, God said it, not me. You have a problem? Take it up with God. And since you don't really have a direct line to God, the sheikh will be the only one with the valid interpretation of God's words. The rise of Abu Ismail was phenomenal. He organized rallies all over the country. The turnout of his supporters was absolutely crazy. What was special about him is that he didn't try to sugarcoat his words. He didn't play the political game the Muslim Brotherhood played when asked about issues like equality, women's rights, minorities, and personal freedom. People liked him because he was not politically correct. He spoke his mind and told it like it is. Again, sound familiar? This was apparent in how he discussed a topic like the hijab. Many Islamic scholars refuse to admit that the Islamic faith forces women to wear it. Alternatively, they still guilt them into wearing it. Abu Ismail laid it out plain and simple. In the army, you can't just wear anything you want. You need to wear the uniform that your leaders dictate to you. So, if God, the leader of all leaders, tells you to wear the hijab, you do it, or else you are not a part of his ranks and in turn you are not a Muslim. You are a defector. This is an act of mutiny. We all know what happens to defectors, right? Make slashing sounds with fingers as you drag it across your throat. The beautiful thing about these people is that they sound as if they are giving you a choice. You either do it or you are not considered a Muslim. This is the definition of entrapment. I desperately tried to host Abu Ismail on my show. I saw one anchor after another fail to confront his bullshit. He could talk ad nauseum and just make things up because the anchors didn't know any better, mainly because they didn't really have a solid background in Islamic history. Now, I was raised in a conservative family, and my father's job as a judge required him to be knowledgeable about Islamic and civil society. I enjoyed reading a lot about history and how Islam has evolved, thanks in part to my father's huge library. I could see right through this guy. I finally got through to one of his close followers, or apprentices. He told me that the sheikh was too busy, but I could come meet him and then we'd take it from there. I went to his house and waited outside in my car. His apprentice told me that he needed to get going to Arali in a town about 2 hour drive away. He could go with you in the car and you can discuss his appearance with you. So for the next 2 hours, I doubled as a chauffeur and as a fixer, trying to get him on the show. He sat next to me with two of his closest followers in the back seat. The guy was very sweet. He talked in a low voice, in a respectful way. His ideology was a disaster, though. It was like having a polite conversation with a serial killer. I didn't want to confront him on his issues because I didn't want to alienate him from coming onto the show. But every time I questioned some of his ISIS-like thoughts, he'd say, "I didn't make this up. They are only God's words." I tried to maintain the stupid anchor character so he would think I was an easy target and come on my show. But then we got on the topic of the rights of religious minorities. You don't accept that other people from different faiths have the right to promote their beliefs in public, do you? I asked him. It is an Islamic country. Only Islam should be promoted openly. Yet we should love and care for our Christian brothers, he said. Then why do many Islamists whine when one Western country bans the burqa or one European city doesn't issue a permit to build a mosque? Why do you welcome and take advantage of the fact that any Muslim can stand in the middle of any major city in America or Europe promoting Islam, but you don't accept the same for others here? That was a stupid mistake. I could see his followers in the back seat frown as I asked. He never lost his smile. He said some bullshit excuses like every country is different and cultures are not alike, and then changed the subject. I knew right then that I had lost my chance. 2 hours for nothing. We arrived at the rally, where at least 10,000 people had come to receive him. He was greeted like a rock star as he came onto the stage. Some of them recognized me. They liked the show and followed me closely. They thought I was funny but hoped that I would take it a little easier on Islam. To them, the likes of Abu Ismail represented real Islam. I watched the rally from a distance with thousands of men cheering on his racist ideas as he laid them out with the biggest of smiles. Over the next few months, this guy's popularity skyrocketed. Thousands of followers were showing up at his rallies, and I was shocked to find that well-educated people were embracing his message. To be fair, he was vocal against the military. Young people loved that. They were growing tired of the revolution being in standstill mode. So they chose a guy who revolted against military dictatorship and hoped to replace it with an Islamic military dictatorship. For some reason, many ignored the second part of the equation. Hazem Abu Ismail eventually ran for president. It was scary to have someone with his mentality and popularity having a shot at the presidency. There was only one technical problem. In Egypt, to run for president, you and your immediate family could not carry another nationality. He was disqualified when it was found that his mother and sister were living in the United States and held American passports. And as we all know by now, America is a horrible, no good, very bad country. Prostituting an ancient civilization. One of the advantages and disadvantages of democracy is that stupid people have the same freedom to speak up. After the revolution, the Islamists expressed what was really on their minds, and it was like giving them the rope with which to hang themselves. Thoughts that were discussed for decades only in their close circles were surfacing freely on the airwaves. Out of nowhere, the Islamists started to attack the pharaohs. Yes, you got that right. They were attacking people who had been dead for thousands of years. A Salafi went on television calling for the Sphinx to be destroyed and for the pyramids to be demolished. He claimed that these were idols and should be destroyed like the Buddha statues in Afghanistan. While he could be viewed as a crazy man who had no weight and no real merit in the Islamist community, when we at the show dug deep, we found very interesting opinions about the issue from their well-known and more popular leaders. The principles and the dogma were one and the same as those of the crazy extremists in Afghanistan or ISIS. The only difference was that the Islamist leaders were diplomatic when they spoke about our ancient civilization. No matter how smart you think you are, your batshit crazy opinion will surface and come back to haunt you. The stupidity went beyond that Salafi guy with plans to destroy the pyramids. It ran deep into Islamist history. In the past, people used God and Islam as excuses to destroy whatever human heritage there was, under the pretense of the monuments or objects being pagan. In all honesty, the Muslim Brotherhood leaders didn't share the same stupid opinions, at least not openly. But when you are running on an "Islam is the solution" slogan, and your biggest ally in the elections and in writing the constitution are Salafis, you risk the generalization. It especially doesn't help when you are an Islamic authority and you generalize against your opponents, calling them degenerate, sex-hungry liberals. Well, it goes both ways. So when one of your allies speaks in favor of pedophile marriages and female genital mutilation and allows for the harassment of women because she bought it on herself by not covering up, yet you still join forces with this ally and appear on their TV shows, well, I really don't feel sorry for you. You earned the same stupid reputation. Anyway, back to the pharaohs. My show's researchers unearthed more videos and stumbled upon a Salafi party leader who had run for parliament in the recent elections, saying that the pharaoh's civilization was rotten. He went on to espouse that since Islam had entered Egypt, we didn't need to study or care about this ancient rotten civilization that worshipped stones and idols. I commented that it is true, if it wasn't for Islam entering Egypt, we would all be stuck in Cairo's horrible traffic on a daily basis trying to get to the pyramids to show our respect and give our offering to our pharaoh gods. Thank goodness we could call to prayer from the comfort of our own homes. Islamists were up in arms against me, saying that I had taken the Salafi leader's words out of context. So I got more videos of him saying that we should ban receiving money from tourism at our ancient Egyptian monuments because it was haram. And if we really needed to keep those statues, we could just put wax masks over them to hide their features. That was a brilliant idea, of course. I suggested, why not put masks in the form of his lovely bearded peaceful face? Surely it wouldn't melt under the hot Egyptian sun. We then got more videos of one of the most credible and respected Salafi leaders suggesting that early Muslims, when they originally took on Egypt, should have destroyed the pharaonic temples and statues. There was one problem, though. The pyramids and the temples were buried under the sand, and it was because of the French invasion of Egypt at the end of the 18th century that these monuments were unearthed. So basically, the early Muslims didn't see them, and if they did, the Muslim thing would be to destroy them. Thank God for sand. You might think that only the backward Salafi sheikhs were in on this ridiculousness, but it was more of a general way of thinking. As a matter of fact, a serious Islamist researcher with a suit and tie instead of your typical Taliban-like outfit came out and claimed that the pyramids were built through money paid in return for sexual favors. He said that the daughters of the three kings who built the famous three pyramids of Giza slept with men for money that was later used to finance the building of the pyramids. Given that there are more than 2 million stones in the Great Pyramid alone, well, that's a lot of sex. Imagine if the pharaohs continued to rule. We would have built a totally new infrastructure through our harem of royal hoes. When we hear now that ISIS is demolishing a temple or demolishing thousands of heritage sites, it doesn't come out of nothing. They all come from the same pitiful extreme source. In Egypt, the Islamists, despite choosing their words carefully, still managed to show their real face. This is actually why I have a bit more respect for the Salafis than the Muslim Brotherhood. At least they are straightforward with their stupidity and bigotry. They are our Muslim rednecks. They are the ones waiting for the rapture and have no problem showing their hate and disdain for others. The Muslim Brotherhood are just power whores, sugarcoating their extreme views with fake political correctness. But when you pull back the curtain, they behave like any regular Muslim hillbilly. Their sugarcoating and tolerance couldn't hold up forever. Something had to give. They went after their enemies, and I was one of them. How to interrogate a joker. There is a warrant for your arrest, my lawyer told me on the phone. Since day one of the live tapings, we were bombarded with accusations and legal complaints against the program. We had around 42 legal complaints against us at the office of the general prosecutor. So far, the prosecutor had moved none of them forward. You see, the way it works here, people place their complaints, but it is up to the prosecutor whether or not to move forward into an actual investigation. Some of the accusations were ridiculous, like the complaint accusing me of tarnishing the relationship with a friendly country, Pakistan. Up to that point, I didn't know we had such a sensitive relationship with Pakistan, and I didn't know how friendly Pakistan was with us. The joke that got me in trouble, though, it was not even a joke. It was a hat. President Morsi, in a visit to Pakistan, received an honorary doctorate. The university that was honoring him had a peculiar academic outfit. He was dressed in a fancy graduation gown and hood. But the hat was so fucking funny that we made a replica of it. The only difference was, we made it 3 feet tall and it weighed 40 pounds. I made my entrance onto the stage wearing this monstrosity in the episode following his visit to Pakistan. That gigantic hat became the most iconic prop piece in Arab television history. We had to put it in the lobby of the theater for people to take pictures with it. But in the end, that hat, coupled with other jokes, pissed off the wrong people. The general prosecutor finally took action. The charges? 1. Insulting the president. Of course. 2. Insulting Islam. Sure. 3. Spreading profanity and destroying the fabric of society. I don't even know what that is. Speaking of fabric, we do have fine Egyptian cotton, though. 4. Disturbing the social peace. Seriously, who comes up with this crap? In Egypt, it is enough to go to the prosecutor to say that you have been psychologically affected by anything someone else says or does and file a complaint. It sounds comical, but in reality, if the government wants it to fly, it will fly. The accusations themselves were maddeningly vague. How do you disturb the peace? How do you destroy the fabric of society? Scissors? But believe it or not, many have been arrested on similar charges. The laws in this patriarchal society can send you to jail for simply not behaving well, which is extremely subjective. The one charge that I was worried about was insulting Islam. This was the single most disturbing charge that could not be defended against. The people sending you to jail may not even be religious, but the charge was an amazing tool to round up the masses against someone. If you are labeled as someone who disrespects Islam, it is like having an opponent with a royal flush in a game of poker. Nothing beats it. There is no trump card. This is the charge that no one would dare defend you against because it would put them in the same box of Islam enemies. Soon, it was all over the news. My ever-worrying mom called me in hysterics. She was afraid that police officers would take me right to jail. An emergency meeting was called at the theater. My lawyer and partners all came to discuss what was happening. It was Monday. The biggest concern for my lawyer was that the police would come to arrest me in my house at night. My biggest concern was that I wouldn't have time to write the next episode. We decided that I shouldn't go home that night. I would sleep at the theater and my wife would sleep over at her parents'. We thought that would buy us time to go to the general prosecutor's office the next day willingly, with no officer putting handcuffs on me. I met with my creative team. Everything should go as planned, I told them. We have a show to shoot in 48 hours. Unless I don't get back, business continues as usual. Can I take your place just this week? Khaled, one of my writers and fake correspondents, asked loudly. No, I should be the one who sits in his chair, Shadi, another fake correspondent and writer, said. Vultures were already circling. It was good that everyone was in high spirits and willing to joke. We continued writing and researching late into the night. I retired to my office alone. I had hardly slept, and by 7 a.m. I was up, ready to willingly turn myself in. And then it hit me. I am in show business. Let's make a bit out of it. I called the prop master and asked him to get the huge hat out. I would go to the general prosecutor's office wearing that hat. My team, upon hearing of my plan, tried to prevent me from going. Dude, are you crazy? They kept asking me on the phone. The arguments went back and forth. I was sticking to my decision. They could take me to court. They could investigate me. And they could issue a warrant for my arrest. But they would do it all while I was making them the laughingstock of the country. That's the only weapon I had. My team arrived at the theater, but none of them walked upstairs to the offices. They all waited for me downstairs. Everyone wanted to come with me to court. I talked to them and told them that, as usual, we were stressed for time. If they put me in jail, we will have no show, I said. But what would be worse is if they release me and you guys wasted time while I was gone and we air a bad show. Then they definitely will win. I made my way to the courthouse. Some of the technical team came along, together with Khalifa, director, Amr, producer, and Abbas, head of communication, and the one who would accompany me 2 years later when I would flee Egypt. The four of us went in one car. Just 18 months earlier, Khalifa and Amr were in my apartment shooting an internet episode with a heart surgeon who, outside of his operating room, was a complete no one. Now, we were the biggest news in town. We were laughing about the notion as we drove. But as we laughed, we knew that it was all for show. Deep down, we were terrified. Many of the technical team followed us in separate cars. The hat was so big, they had to rent it its own pickup truck. It was going to be the highlight of my entrance. We arrived at the courthouse. The streets were packed. Hundreds of people had come out with signs and banners to support me. They were angry at the Islamic government for harassing the Joker. Dozens of cameras and reporters from everywhere were there too. The journalists were shouting at me for a comment as I went through the crowd of bodies. This was like the red carpet for a movie premiere, with the slight difference being that I could end up in jail. I, my crew, the reporters, the cameramen, the supporters, the haters, and the security forces were all moving together in an unconventional dance toward the doors of the courthouse. I tried to keep the biggest smile on my face. With all these cameras, I didn't want a single photo showing me frowning or worried. I didn't want the Islamists to have some disparaging photo of me to put their stupid comments on. I wouldn't give them the satisfaction. I kept waving and smiling, holding the image of a smiling Joker in the face of oppression. As I was pushed, shoved, and herded along in the swarming mass of reporters, I could only think about those TV sheikhs celebrating the day I was presented to justice. They wanted to see me broken and defeated. I instructed one of the production assistants to walk behind me while he held the giant Morsi hat above my head. The might of the Islamist government was instantly humiliated by a single silly prop. I was smiling and laughing and throwing jokes, and yet inside, I was worried I would not sleep at home that night. We finally reached the front door of the court. I stood on top of the stairs and put the hat on. Here I was, with a comically tall hat, talking to the crowd through a megaphone. I did a mini stand-up routine there while my fans laughed, and my lawyer glared at me angrily. I was making a scene. An officer told us to follow him to a back entrance into the court. Finally, I was inside. Court employees were coming to take photos and selfies with me as we moved, shouting at me in support. Only one woman came close to me and prayed that God would bring down his rage and vengeance on me. "May you fry in hell," she shouted. What a good little Muslim she must be. We arrived at the interrogation room, which was the office of the chief deputy of the prosecutor. The deputy asked me to sit down. He was a polite, quiet man who weighed three times more than me. In Egypt, during interrogations, we don't use video cameras or audio recorders. We have the stenographer, who is designated to write down everything as fast as you say it, in the most horrible handwriting. You wonder if it could ever really qualify as evidence. As we were about to start, several young attorneys came into the room. They were from the general prosecutor's office. They told me that they were fans of the show and started taking photos with me. This was absolutely insane. More police officers came in, asking to take photos with me. The deputy eventually asked them to get it over with so we can start the interrogation. We finally started. The deputy asked for the episodes in question so they could play them for me and ask their questions. A middle-aged guy came into the office with a few CDs. He then put one of them into an extremely outdated computer on the deputy's desk. The computer had a Windows 95 operating system, and the disks didn't work. I was not surprised. Why would anything work in this place? I tried helping them. I asked them if they had VLC or any other updated version of Media Player. The whole scene was surreal. I was fucking helping them so they could play video evidence against me. At a certain point, I was wondering if they had downloaded too much porn on that computer and ended up fucking it completely, figuratively speaking. After more than 45 minutes, they gave up trying. "Okay, so I will just assume that you know your episodes, and I will say that we just played the episodes for you," the deputy said. "So, We will ask you questions based on the written script, as if we played the episodes, okay? Do I have another choice? Not really. The first question was about the first charge, insulting Islam. Since we didn't have any videos to play, the deputy started to read the transcript from one of my episodes. It was the one in which the Islamist media were celebrating how we now had a pious Islamic president who went to mosques and led the prayers. The Islamist media circus was all over it, showing different photos of Morsi posing in different prayer stages. In one of our episodes, we made a fake infomercial where you could win a place next to the president in a mosque of your choice if you called a certain number. The commercial showed how fast you would go to heaven with all the divine perks if you called the number, let alone the grand prize of meeting the pious president in this amazing spiritual experience. As the deputy read the script, many in the room started laughing, which continued all throughout the interrogation. The plan was to play it dumb. What? Insulting Islam? Me? Never. In that same episode, we made fun of angry sheikhs who would shout during their sermons at people attending the Friday prayer service. You see, for some reason, many sheikhs like to bring the terrors of hell in the afterlife to our mortal doorstep. Imagine a pastor during a Sunday sermon shouting at the top of his lungs, telling you that God would unleash his wrath on you and throw you in a fiery pit, where your skin would melt in front of your eyes. Okay, I get it. That's not that hard to imagine, as we have already demonstrated that radical Christians and radical Muslims are not that different. The only difference where we come from is that we do our shaming sessions on Friday and you do yours on Sundays. Same scare tactics, different days of the week. How is criticizing imams alienating people from Islam considered an insult to Islam? I asked the deputy. Well, many were offended by your jokes, he answered. Well, many more are offended on a weekly basis with those who tell us that we are all going to hell, I said in a slightly mocking tone. Why not bring them here for questioning? My lawyer interjected and said, my client has absolute respect for the Muslim faith and is a Muslim himself. His words were taken out of context and there is no insult to the faith here. He then leaned on my shoulder and whispered, this is not your theater and these people are not your audience. Then he added firmly, if you want to get out of here, play along. No need to make big statements. No need to be a hero. I regurgitated my lawyer's statement in an almost robotic manner. I had no ill intentions, I said. I respect the Islamic faith. The interrogation proceeded to another accusation, insulting the president. In one of our episodes, we showed an exclusive interview with President Morsi, which he gave on the same night as the Academy Awards in Los Angeles. Because of the time difference between Cairo and LA, the Oscars ceremony would start at 4 a.m. Cairo time. Morsi's interview was supposed to air at 8 p.m. Word was out that he had made so many gaffes that the interview had to be edited and re-edited, which kept people waiting until it actually aired after midnight and very close to the airtime of the Oscars. We came up with the idea that Morsi wanted to compete with the viewership of the Oscars and made a whole Oscar-themed episode. Every time he would say something that was untrue, like listing false achievements of the government or any other bullshit rhetoric, I would appear after each video clip to give him an Oscar, one for best actor, best writer, best fiction, best liar, etc. The interrogator recited the script to me, there was no video, remember, and asked, what did you mean when you said Oscar best actor, Oscar best director, etc.? I try explaining the idea of the Oscar ceremony and how we tried to draw similarities between the two television events. His next question blew my mind. What are the Oscars? Excuse me, I said in disbelief. What are the Oscars? Why do you consistently refer to them in the episode? It took me a bit of time to realize that he was not joking. Even the younger attorneys in the room from the generous prosecutor's office were stifling their giggles. So for the next 10 minutes, I proceeded to try to explain what the Oscars were. After I finished, he said, so why is this funny? I have to say I was deeply hurt. My comedy was not appealing to him. However, trying to appeal to the humor of a man who had no point of cultural reference would have been damn near impossible. Perhaps a fart joke would have been the common denominator. We continued with one question after the other, and one accusation after the other. I continued to play dumb, denying that I was making fun of the president. But then the prosecutor asked me, If this was not an insult, why are the people in the theater laughing? I don't know. I guess you need to go and ask them, I answered with a smile. This went on for 6 hours. 6 hours of questioning my jokes and my puns. The mental gymnastics that I had to go through were excruciating. At the end of all this, I was released on bail. In the days that followed, everyone who was involved in those episodes, the producers, the owner of the channel, everyone, were all brought in to be questioned. 2 days later, I did my show, recreating all the events that led to my interrogation, including the major fiasco outside the courthouse. The joke was turned against the regime. I made a total fool out of them. Even Jon Stewart came to my defense and made a segment about this on his show. What was really interesting, though, were the different reactions of the Islamists and the liberal media. The Islamists were asking for my head and called for the permanent banning of my show. When I say they were asking for my head, I literally mean that. In the Arab world, people are used to calling into religious programs to ask for fatwas in all aspects of life. This could range from asking whether it is okay to put your money in a Western infidel bank, to praying before going to the bathroom, to, wait for it, whether it is haram to have a threesome with your two wives. Yes, those were actual questions on religious shows. But you can also ask if you can kill someone or not. That happened with me. A famous sheikh went on television saying that many people had called in and emailed him asking if it's okay to kill Bassem Youssef. What? Who asked for this shit? Instead of denouncing this, the sheikh responded, and I told them, not now. Others went on their shows claiming that I was originally an Israeli planted in Egypt by the Mossad. I guess that earlier talk about us being an almost Jewish family is not too far from the truth. That, of course, went along with other ridiculous claims, such as me being part of the Freemasons and following the 13th and 17th protocols of the Elders of Zion, whatever the hell that means. Also, why not the 14th and 18th protocols? Not good enough? This might sound funny and absurd, but the matter of the fact is, Egypt and the rest of the Islamic world has a history of writers, artists, and even cartoonists slaughtered by angry, jealous Muslims who acted upon a fatwa or religious incitement of hate. So you can imagine the state my wife and my parents were in. Meanwhile, the liberal media were up in arms defending my program. Less than 18 months later, the Islamists who called for banning me were banned themselves under the same rule of law. The liberals turned a blind eye as my program was eventually banned. Some of them even blessed the ban. It's funny, not haha funny, but funny sad, how principles and morals could be tailored as needed. I was there. I saw it happen firsthand. I saw people calling for my freedom, but later celebrating when I was shut down. Those who called themselves liberals proved later that being well-dressed, eloquent, and standing up against Islamist fascism doesn't really mean you are a liberal. On the day of my interrogation, the joke was on the Islamists. But a year later, the liberals, with their new joke that kept on giving. It's all downhill from here. Around March 2013, a movement sprung out of nowhere called Tamarrud, which in Arabic means rebellion. It appeared first as a grassroots movement, which called for Morsi to step down and for new elections to follow. These protesters demanded the constitution be rewritten and to have everyone included in writing it. The movement gave Morsi until June 30, 2013, to respond to their demands. As expected, the Islamist media lashed out. The Islamists were becoming too predictable, with their usual rhetoric and accusations of this movement being funded by the usual suspects, the Coptic Christian Church, America, Israel, etc. Morsi continued to marginalize anyone from a non-Islamic background. The Muslim Brotherhood were putting their own people everywhere. The Islamization of the state was swiftly underway. My brother worked in an oil company owned by the government. He told me that during that time, Muslim Brotherhood members with no experience, talent, or skills were getting hired in all positions within the company. He said that once during a lunch hour, one of his colleagues, a Muslim Brotherhood member, who had been promoted for no apparent reason, was standing with him outside the company building. He looked up and said, "In a matter of months, this godforsaken company will be under control." When my brother asked him what they were going to do with the army and the police and how they were going to control them, he answered, "No, that will take a couple of years, but eventually it will happen. This pattern was repeated with many different companies and mosques. The same arrogance I saw when I met Al-Shatir was materializing on the ground. When you ask Egyptians about why they hated the Muslim Brotherhood enough to turn a blind eye to all the injustice and killing that happened to the Brotherhood after they were removed from power, more on that coming up, many would tell you that the Brotherhood would have done the same to us. It was more of a feeling of those people are coming to dominate us and use religion to enslave us. Many women will tell you about how they were walking in the streets and bearded men or veiled women would shout at them, "It's our country now and all of you will be covered soon." It's like when Trump supporters started cursing at people and telling them they will be deported after Trump won the election. It's like when that guy got up on a Delta flight and shouted at everyone, "Trump is your president, all of you Hillary bitches." It doesn't matter that these were isolated incidents or that the president didn't officially endorse them. A certain atmosphere was created and people can see the direct link to authority. The Brotherhood had a talent of finding more and more ways to make themselves unlikable. They were like that younger obnoxious sibling who, when you tell him to leave you alone, sticks his finger as close as humanly possible to your face and proclaims, "I'm not touching you." The Brotherhood was hated. And the worst thing they could possibly do would be to go further to the right to spite everyone. Yet, that's exactly what Morsi did. He called for a huge rally, where he gathered his supporters in the biggest sports arena in Cairo. The context for the rally was supporting people in war-torn Syria, but what we saw was different. Thousands and thousands of President Morsi supporters with banners calling for jihad, singing songs calling for jihad, and wearing green headbands screamed that they were ready for jihad. During the speeches, the thin line between jihad in Syria and jihad in Egypt disappeared. The insinuations, the references, slowly shifted from fighting God's enemies in Syria to fighting them here in Egypt. This looked like a heavy metal concert that had gone horribly wrong. Even worse, Morsi sat right smack in the middle of the most right-wing bigoted Salafi sheikhs. It was the first time that he had associated himself openly with those people in a political setting. One sheikh after another came up to the podium to give his best hate speech. It was just short of a witch hunt party. They asked the Almighty Allah to curse and strike down those planning to demonstrate on June 30th. This happened while the jihad crazed crowd cheered and the president sat there awfully silent. Whatever attempts the Muslim Brotherhood made for over a year to convince us that they were the acceptable light version of political Islam went down the drain on that day. We had so much hate going around that dissing the anti-Muslim people was not enough. So they had to bring in other people to hate and call for their death just for the fuck of it. In front of everyone, including the president, a famous sheikh demanded that no Shiites be admitted in Egypt, just as relations with Iran were starting to get closer. Wait, what? The Salafi sheikhs sure love to spread the hate around. They hate Christians, Jews, liberals, other Muslim Sunni, whom they consider to be less pious, and they still have some leftover hate to go around for Shias. At this point, you are probably hitting Muslim info overload and are having a hard time understanding the hate between Sunni and Shias. In a nutshell, think of the Red Sox and the Yankees. Now give each of them a country, Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now give both of them a good amount of oil, loads of money, absolute rule by their religions, lots of weapons, hateful ideology that crosses borders, and add to that a feud that originated 1500 years ago over who should be the successor of the Prophet Muhammad. That should be good enough. We have very few Shiites in Egypt, but they are just another minority that the extreme Sunni sheikh, who are openly funded by the Saudis, love to shit on. So a few days after that lovely speech against Shiites, calling them filth and unholy, 5 Shias were killed in a remote village in Egypt. I wonder, if 5 people were killed as a result of direct incitement of hate in a speech, what will happen to the rest of us who oppose the Islamist regime? Would killing us be any more difficult? Here we had a direct sectarian speech full of violent rhetoric that would rival a Nazi party rally openly calling for a Holocaust on anyone who opposed the president. If they could incite enough hate against a minority to have them killed a few days later, what would happen to the rest of the people they incited hate against if these people openly protested the dictatorship? The Brotherhood had used their militias before. They could use them again. As June 30th approached, it was difficult to stay hopeful, and yet something amazing occurred that made me believe there was still some good in the world. No, we didn't all suddenly get along with glitter parades in the streets and cupcakes and lollipops for everyone. However, it was the second best thing to that. John Stewart came to Egypt. John versus the Pyramids. By now, you probably recognize that I am beyond just a groupie fangirl for John Stewart. People usually are obsessed with rock stars, models, and actors like Matthew McConaughey, well, at least before that weird car commercial, and not often a short Jewish satirist from New Jersey. But it was because of him that I started my own show and had my own theater. Well, it was a rental, but that's beside the point. I had been on his show twice already, and he had written an article about me for Time magazine when I was chosen as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. What more could I ask for? Well, other than having him on the show. This dream came true when John was shooting his movie Rosewater in neighboring Jordan. He agreed to come on the show the last week of our season, 2 days before June 30th. Leading up to that day, things were very uncomfortable in Egypt. The countdown to the 30th had left the country heated and threatening to boil over. What if all hell broke loose when he was here and I couldn't get him out of Egypt? His fans and Comedy Central would kill me. I sent John an email I never thought I would have had to write. John, I'm sorry, but the 28th is too close to a very heated and unpredictable day. I don't think I can guarantee your safety. I hit send and just kept kicking myself over and over. Fuck politics, really. Why couldn't we just get along long enough for John to visit and happily kill each other after he left? John replied with one sentence. How about I come the week before? That was in 2 days. Seriously? A new definition of awesomeness should be added in Webster's, and this guy's photo should be next to it. Of course I agreed. I had to cancel an interview with a famous politician to talk about the coming events. But you know what? Who cared? Not me. So John made it to Egypt. Abbas arranged for a private security company to escort him, and Amr made sure that the police and secret service were involved. He was accompanied by bodyguards whose necks were as thick as his torso. When he arrived at the theater, the entire street was on lockdown. Bystanders were curious if Morsi had agreed to come on the show. But then, this short white guy with a long white beard, he was in movie shooting mode, got out of the car. It was difficult for them to get a good look at him, as he was overshadowed by the huge bodies all dressed in black towering over him. I hadn't told my researchers. Only a close circle of people around me knew. When John entered the editing room, everyone screamed, and the girls almost threw their panties on the imaginary stage. More conservative women in my team considered throwing their hijabs. It seemed I am loved here more than New York, John said. I should consider moving here. I took him for a tour around the theater. I felt like a proud student showing my teacher my science project. This theater kicks ass, he said. He entered my office and noticed the posters with some of his quotes like, I'm not going to censor myself to comfort your ignorance. He looked at them and just said, nice, in classic Stewart style. We sat down and prepared for his appearance on the show. We thought that his entrance should be totally different from what we usually did. When the moment came, I announced in classic propaganda style that we had captured a foreign spy who was planning to commit crimes against the nation. John was escorted onto the stage, wearing a black sack over his head, a la Abu Ghraib prison chic. The moment I removed the sack off his head, the theater erupted in screams, laughter, and cheers. I actually think there were real panties thrown on the stage this time. The applause went on for nearly 2 minutes. I wasn't the only Egyptian infatuated with this man. John was incredible. He actually learned some dirty words in Arabic and shared them on air. The audience ate it up. What was amazing about this interview was how we openly spoke about satire, power, and politics. He said something that still resonates with the people in Egypt. If your regime can't take a joke, you don't have a regime. This sentence went viral all over the region. John never imagined that he, an American Jew, would be welcomed in the heart of Cairo and have his coats resonate with everyone. It was a moment where people from different cultures connected. Comedy and laughter against tyranny seemed to unite us, if only briefly. Naturally, the Islamists attacked me in their media. "He is getting an American Jew to support him before the 30th of June," was the common sentiment. They even analyzed some of the jokes we cracked as Masonic signals that have evil intentions about Jews coming back to Egypt and taking over. Yep, that kind of crazy. But all that didn't matter. This was not just my idol coming to my show. It was validation. I remember joking with my staff after his visit saying, "Well, we can't top that, people. Maybe it is time to shut down the show and retire." Careful what you wish for.